We're alive, and I'm alive.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Well, you may be seated. Rose, you may be seated. Yeah. I'm not too happy with, and I don't hear myself down here. I don't think my sound is right. Don't think it's on. Now I'm getting a little bit, but not now. That's better, but that's too much. You got to pull it down a little. Now you may hear things out there where you're listening, but we have a different sound system here. We have a live audience, and I didn't have sound proper down here. Can you hear me okay now?
Yes, sir.
Okay now?
Yes, sir.
As I was saying, I'm not too happy with the reservations for the cathedral. I'm not too happy with the show-up ratio. I'm not going to make any big deal out of it. I'll just close the doors on the cathedral and have my 29th anniversary and the start of my 30th year at King's House One. Just give me a reason, folks. Just give me a reason. I will win my battle of faith. With or without your help. You'll be honored to participate if you do. But I didn't last 29 years as pastor. And all the years of ministry before I came here, without understanding how fickle congregations are. Some of you remember I said, over the years I wanted to minister. I didn't want to be a pastor the congregation had to minister to. I learned in my first assignment at the headquarters church of the Assemblies of God, where the pastor was going through a near fatal physical battle, how there's always a core within a congregation that are faithful. The majority of people want to find a church where they're made to feel good. They escape their own problems. And they're not made to wrestle with anything. That's where I coined the phrase when I saw how disinterested the congregation was in ministering strength to Jim Van Meter through his battle. It so weakened him, and family members got involved, and there were things going on I couldn't continue to participate with. I said good things about his ministry and left. I remember coming here 29 years ago. The pastor had founded the church and had been here for 28 years. Bastion of Faith. Faith Center was the name of the church. The true pioneer in religious broadcasting. First 24-hour program, don't care what they tell you about Pat Robinson. Ray Schock started it all. PTL, both not too proud of this, but they were in their beginnings. Jim Baker and Tammy and Paul Crouch and Jan started on that platform at King's House One, Faith Center. That's where PTL was born. Paul Crouch was the manager of the television ministry. They left what they thought was a sinking ship. About a year and a half before, the church called me. And they went together in Orange County, and then for whatever reason they couldn't get along. And Jim and Tammy went to Carolina, and Paul and Jan stayed. John 40. Ray Schock had lost his health, had a pacer in his heart. He invited me down. The board barred him from coming to the first meeting. So I told them to get lost. I told the business manager, sure, to get out. They want to talk to me. The pastor's going to be there. That's what made me say they had two problems. I said, you've got two problems much greater than your financial problem. And that was big. They owed $3.4 million, had $19,000 cash, and they owed it in 30 days. It's a pretty big financial problem. That's why I said, any people think I came down here and ripped this place off, at least even my enemies know I'm too smart to pick something like that. I can find a better bird to pluck than that. Oh, $3.4 million in 30 days and got $19,000 cash. I said, you got a bigger problem than your financial problem. By the way, the congregation didn't know they owed it. I was the first to tell them. From the pulpit, you owe $3.4 million. You can hear all over the congregation. But I said to that board, I said, you got a spiritual problem bigger than your financial. You've lost faith. You ought to change the name of this church to Fear Center instead of Faith Center. You ought to change the network from Faith Broadcasting Network to Fear Broadcasting Network. And you've lost respect for God-ordained leadership. Unless you can face and solve those problems, nothing I can do to help you, and I got them walked out. That's when they came in the afternoon and asked if I would pastor. And you know the story. I wrote down 16 terms so tough that I could pride myself I hadn't said no, but I wrote conditions so tough I knew they wouldn't say yes. Went back to San Francisco, knowing and feeling good about myself, I hadn't said no. Called my dad and read the terms. He said, you don't want to be pastor, do you, son? And I said, no. And I got what felt like a death sentence on Tuesday night because I demanded a unanimous vote. First from the board, they were to vote all 16 terms, and then one of the 16 terms, they were to resign immediately. After recommending unanimous vote to the congregation. I knew that would never happen. And I get a call at 11 o'clock or something like that on Tuesday night in the hotel I was staying in San Francisco, making my plans to head to South Africa. I was the chief executive of the denomination. At our annual meeting, I don't think I ever told you this, a couple of brethren had come from South Africa, said they had a vision that a mist or a fog was across South Africa and that I was to come there and teach and the fog would lift. I had no belief that they would accept those 16 terms and vote unanimous. At 11 o'clock, I get the phone call. Hello, Pastor. Like a death sentence. But except for me, the church was not even going to retire Pastor Schock. Not even provide a retirement. after founding the church, and 28 years of faithful service and broken health. I said, oh, my dead body. And made sure retirement was provided. I know all about congregations. I repeat, I'll win my battle of faith in the current test, with or without you. That there are certain stress elements I don't intend to fight any longer. Sunday morning at the cathedral is not a congregation. The congregation's listening right now, all across the world. The cathedral is a studio audience. That's all you are on Sunday morning. The church is 24 hours a day as a people who belong to the Lord. And frankly, I don't have too much use for people in this congregation that have not cared enough about the teaching to have shortwave, internet, or small dish, or big dish, 24-hour accessibility. The teaching goes forth 24 hours a day. Oh, there are people listening tonight and listen every night here in Los Angeles who just listen for the teaching. They probably go to another church, take what I teach, learn from it, and teach a Sunday school class. Or pastor a church. The congregation are those king's tithers and king's dishes and king's and Philippian band members around the world to whom this ministry has brought life and who recognize that they are called to be a part of it and to support this teaching around the world. Everybody else is just hangers-on and self-serving, self-seeking. Plunderers at the table. I don't intend to fight the stress anymore. They're trying to get you to come to a feast on Sunday morning. We have another place. We have a sanctuary in Glendale. I can teach there without the audio problems we had this morning. There were calls somewhere between the microwave connection at the cathedral and the uplink at King's House 1. No need to move that studio down there. Don't need all the parking and traffic problems. Can sell the Bible collection and endow this ministry till Jesus comes. I don't need you to hold my arms up and fight through this battle of faith with me. I'll win this battle of faith with the few that really care. I will not go through another winter having to fight for these reservations and for your faithfulness in keeping your word and attendance on Sunday morning. Just that simple. It's not a threat. This is a simple statement. I can line 3 blackboards up at King's House 1. Turn a microphone on and teach the same truth to the world with 300 people present or 30 people present. I'm tired of catering to you. Now, I'm not going to say very much for the next few minutes. you're going to get on the phone, you're going to jam these phones with reservations. Or I probably will announce that Anniversary Sunday, 2 weeks from Sunday, will occur at King's House 1. Now, I seem to remember every year about anniversary time we have this same battle. And the rest of you remember it?
Yes, sir.
Except this year, I have too many other problems of faith that I have to battle through. I eliminate some stress-producing problems I don't need. When the time came that Jesus was to be offered up, he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem. I haven't got time. Nor am I inclined to keep paying the money we pay for this time on 56 to sit here and talk you into making your reservations. You're a spoiled brat congregation. 50% of you do not even tithe, which makes you a congregation of thieves and robbers. You're not faithful to your commitments. And the congregation within a congregation will probably be the congregation, namely those that are left of the 300 who really mean business. You've had me for 29 years, given it my all. I'm starting my 30th year in 2 weeks. I don't need another year of a one-sided love affair. The ones that count in this congregation will go just as faithfully to King's House 1. The rest of you, I don't really give a hoot about. It may come as a great shock to you. Go watch Gone with the Wind. I've come to that. Frankly, I don't give a damn. You better get on the phone real fast and straighten your act out, you that are members of my congregation, because in about 10 minutes I'm going to take us to a classic festival in 1987 just to prove a point to those that like to tune in occasionally that I haven't changed much. In 1987, I managed to express myself rather eloquently about TV evangelists. In fact, I told them they had to bleep out something I said just for the sake of those stations that are on air tonight during family time. It's not as though some Johnny-come-lately just hears me and can't figure out why that I feel as I do about being called a TV evangelist. I'm going to play you a classic from 1987. I'm just teaching on another subject. But my attitude toward TV evangelists manages to leak through. As long ago as 1987. I was a little older then, based on appearance. So you only got 10 minutes, so you better get busy on the phone right now. All right. No more calls, and I'm having a problem with the sound down here again. We started with it now. Can you hear me okay back there? How about back here?
Yes, sir.
In 1987, I was teaching on a lot of subjects that we don't spend time with now because they're replaying on the network and the teaching is rather timeless. Do they have that festival in 1987 ready?
Yes, sir.
Now, when this starts, because this is a tape we pulled out of the archives, it hasn't been sent out for professional cleaning up of the sound, and it's an old tape. But it gets better as it goes along in terms of the technical quality of the sound. So put up with a little static during the start. I'll be here. We'll be taking your calls. I may be interrupting at various times. This is pulling out of the classic archives. This is 1987. We had a different opening then. We had the opening of the globe with the lines going around the globe showing where the shortwave coverage reached around the globe. But we're going to play it from that opening. And I want you to listen particularly to the fact that that was 1987. And I had the right attitude toward TV evangelists. That's the main reason I'm playing it. So let it roll, folks. Well, we'll be here taking your calls. Don't go away. I'll be interrupting. I'll be here when it's over. But I want you to see this. Get on the telephone. If you haven't made your reservations, we'll take your calls while this plays. You can do two things, walk and chew gum at the same time. But let it roll. Well, we're live now. 180 years ago in 1773, Pierre Simon de Laplace, then 23 years old, stood before the Academy of Sciences in Paris and read a paper, Light, in which he proved the stability of the solar system. 1773. All deflections of the planets from their paths are only periodic oscillations, he said, from their mean courses, or their regular average course. And the celestial mechanism is wound up to go on forever. The thesis of Simon de Laplace. Laplace's contemporary, Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, set out to demonstrate in a series of works that this earth has ever been an abode of peaceful evolution, free from spasmodic disturbances in opposition to the dominant views of his day. Now, each of these men lived from 1749 to 1827. Well, in that period, Lamarck lived from 1744 to 1829. Interesting messengers these men were, timed on the stage of history to pre-program, to use a Greek word, the cosmos, the worldview of things. Now, the Apostle Peter, whom God let preach the very first sermon on the day of Pentecost, was judged by Jesus to be the spokesman of Satan. When he said, "Get behind me, Satan." So I don't mean to attack the honesty or character of these scientists. Anyone has to watch that they don't become the mouthpiece of the dragon. But the timing is significant. Up until this period, cataclysms were accepted. The worldview was still open pretty much to the biblical frame, with plenty of error, but open. Satan certainly knew that the time span of 2,520 years that was rolling regarding several things in God's set times was about to end. A burst of knowledge would appear in the archaeological and historic world, and language world that would enable the proof of God's control on history to be demonstrated. So the dragon, ever at work, began to reshape the viewpoint of the world that's dominated pretty much ever since. They were in opposition to the dominant views of their day. you may think that this world frame that dominates present society has been around since Neolithic man. Not so. Very recent. These ideas of harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres gained ground in the 19th century and became the foundation of scientific thought. In 1846, Leverdier, by announcing the existence of the planet Neptune, which was immediately thereafter discovered in the part of the sky indicated by him, proved the gravitational theory of Newton and the orderly universe of Laplace, or Laplace, to be correct. This theory of uniformity, as understood by Lamarck and Hutton and developed by Lyell, became the cornerstone of the Darwinian theory. And Darwin went so far as to say that anybody who was unconvinced by Lyell's teaching should refrain from reading The Origin of Species. The principle of uniformity, or the explanation of all past events in the history of the globe in terms of the processes in action in our own age, or the denial of catastrophic crises in the past, gave Darwin what he needed most for his idea, which really wasn't his. He stole it. What Darwin needed most for his idea of the origin of species: almost unlimited time, with things going on the same way. In order that from the struggle for existence or competition, new forms should evolve, and that an animal like the spider with its many legs and human beings should have had a common ancestor, untold eons were necessary. Without change. In the harmonious, do it the same way procedure. By the end of the 19th century, the war between the theory of evolution and the theory of creation in 6 days, less than 6,000 years ago, was concluded with victory to the theory of evolution. The only difficulty left was, in the view of Thomas Huxley, that no really new species had appeared on the world scene since the scientific observations were made, not even in breeding experiments. The geological record, however, spoke unequivocally of the fact in the past lived animal forms that don't live any longer. And of the forms that live in our age, many were not present in the geologic past. Laplace's theory of the origin of the solar system from a rotating nebula was replaced by the end of the century with a theory of a catastrophic beginning and a near collision of the sun with another star, with debris forming the planets. But it was stressed by the authors of this new theory that the universe is orderly, and this beginning in a cataclysm was an unusually rare occurrence in the cosmos. Now, I'm interrupting this. This was 1987 when I was in the midst of teaching on the cataclysmic theory, that a vast gulf of time exists between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. The King James record reads, "In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth." And Genesis 1:2, "And the earth was without form and void." The only problem with that is the verb being translated was just as equally translates became. You don't have two tenses in the Hebrew: perfect, completed in the past, and done by now, or the imperfect, still going on, or future. That's it. Became is past. Was is past. Either translation fits. Jeremiah uses the exact same words of the cataclysm striking the earth, and the earth became a waste and a desolation at a time when there was no man. Yet there were meeting places, a yar in the Hebrew, translated cities in the King James, that simply means a meeting place of intelligent beings. Doesn't necessarily, well, he said there wasn't any man. Now, that's pretty heavy teaching in 1987. I've been doing heavy teaching for 29 years. But the thrust of the teaching is, and I'm reading because this is full in a festival that was in process, even though it opened with the full opening. I'm reading from Velikovsky, one of the great creative thinkers of all time, who had his work constantly attacked and suppressed by the fixed views of the cosmos that were held in his day. He totally shattered by analyzing the Egyptian side of the Exodus and the Tel Armani tablets, and totally shattered the idea of the established date of the Exodus and pushed it back to the mid-1400s or the 15th century. Velikovsky, in his series of books, Worlds in Collision, the one best known, proves by his studies that the biblical view of cyclical time and man at one time being better and cataclysm striking the earth and the successor being lesser, instead of a straight line continuity of progress upward. That's what this teaching's about. Attacking the blind acceptance of the presuppositions of the modern scientism. In the opening series of the teaching on Romans, I handled it in a much more modern way, taking into account the last 15 years of scientific additive research. But this is heavy stuff. You need to listen to it. It will also sort the congregation out. Those who just want to be entertained, they'll go somewhere else. They'll watch the World Series, or they'll watch something else. They'll watch the Lakers. I watch the Lakers to see them get beat. I mean, there was once I was a Laker fan. Now I watch them to see them get beat. I mean, I've never seen such overpaid egos in my life. I mean, you know, the fans are left out. It's just a crass business. And somewhere, but I doubt it, the general public will wake up to these overpaid boneheads. And I watch them to see them get beat, which means I only have to waste my time watching the last 2 minutes. And when I turn it on, if the score's so much in favor of the Lakers, they're bound to win, I turn it off. I was a dyed-in-the-wool Laker fan. Not anymore. And I see such idiotic things as comparing some new kid out of high school to a potential on the Clippers, a potential Magic Johnson. He didn't deserve to be mentioned in the same breath as Magic Johnson. At least college brought the players a little closer to manhood. We just got overpaid teenagers. I mean, you know, I'm adding the NBA to my axis of evil now. So, Go watch basketball. Go watch baseball. Go watch something else if you don't want to think. This is pretty heavy teaching. But the real reason I'm playing is I'm going to get somehow from the cataclysmic theories and a canopy, and there's something wrong with the sound in here because I've lost it again down here. Am I correct, folks? I mean, I've lost my sound down here in the studio. So I don't know what's going on up there, but I'm losing my sound down here. Just now getting it back a little bit. So I'm saying, and you're getting the same sound, I hope, out there that doesn't have the problem. This has to do only with my studio audience. But in the midst of teaching on the cataclysmic theory and the sounds going up and down, and teaching on what was first introduced by a Pasadena scientist, Isaac Vail, the canopy theory to explain no rain and longevity of life before the flood and a lot of other things, I somehow manage to get from those intelligent subjects to television evangelists. That's why I'm replaying this, to show that my present attitude isn't new. This was 1987. And that guy teaching looks older than I do now. But let it go, right where I stopped it. They can't do that?
Created by Laplace, and the earth is governed by the law of uniformity, and the animals and plants by the law of evolution through continuity. I look or sound like a television evangelist?
No,
that's right, I'm not, so don't be stupid. Think I'm one. If you're looking for a television evangelist, turn the knob. They're good with knobs. Or try to be. It appeared that, basic principles having been established, science had before, or in front of it, only the work of refinement in observation and in the addition of details for the perfection of knowledge. But the time of basic discoveries was over. This was the outlook in 1895. In April of that year, Fridtjof Nansen, in an attempt to discover the North Pole, reached a point less than 4 degrees from it. The scientific world looked upon the discovery of the North Pole as the most coveted goal still left to be attained by science. But before Nansen, drifting from latitude 86 degrees and 14 minutes, reached his home in Norway, the scene changed. Conrad Röntgen of Würzburg discovered the X-rays, or cathode ray, that passes through opaque bodies. In the same year of 1895, 20-year-old Marconi, working at the home of his father near Bologna, made the first successful experiment with wireless transmission. We sometimes forget how much has happened in the last 100 years. My Lord, if we could live another 100 years, those that are smart among us, or 900 years. That year, too, Freud published his first paper, together with Joseph Breuer, which led to a new understanding of the realm known as the subconscious. Now, some of you probably don't know that Freud's first work was with a Breuer. That could explain a lot about the subconscious. At the same time, Pavlov made his contribution to the psychology of the reflexes. That's a pretty good combination. Freud and sex, Pavlov and dogs, and a brewer in the middle. The next year, and still before Nansen had landed on the Norwegian coast, Henry Becquerel, working on uranium, discovered the phenomenon of radioactivity. 2 years later, he was followed by Curie, who discovered radium. In 1897, J.J. Thompson announced that the atom is divisible and is actually a microcosm. And he was followed by Rutherford. In 1900, Planck presented the theory of quanta, or energies dispatched in bundles or shots and not in a continuous stream. And in the field of the origin of species, in 1900, Van Vries announced mutation in plants, observed for the first time a process of spontaneous change in living nature, fundamentally different from the process of evolution through continuity as postulated by Darwin. Thus, in a few years, in a spectacular series of discoveries, the entire world, matter and energy, living species, and the human soul opened new horizons, and everything appeared to be in incessant vibration, collisions, and transformation. The macrocosm, the microcosm, and even the subtle world of the mind, all alike, facing catastrophe. In my judgment, membership in my church, if I were to put a standard on it, which I don't, Jesus accepts you, I do. I'm interested in policing you. But if I had entrance requirements, I make everybody read Emmanuel Velikovsky. You take a test on it. If you understand him, you can make it. One of the most creative thinkers the world has seen. And he shook the world up. Worlds in collision. Three-volume series, Ages in Chaos. And I'm reading from Earth in Upheaval. Not the main book, but an address before the Graduate College Forum of Princeton University on October 14, 1953. The title of the address, 1895 and 1950, The Time Was Ripe for Heresy. If I have a goal for anyone, it's to open their mind. Now, if in the process of opening the mind, I can introduce a God that isn't dumping on you all the time, who will take an open-minded person with the courage to faith and give him salvation, fine. You've added to the number of heaven that will make it attractive to be there. But I'm not trying to convert anybody. If I did what I was trained to do, I'd be teaching in a religion department or a philosophy department at a university and have a handful of students. More interested in girls than what I was talking about. By doing it on television at this late night hour, I have the privilege of teaching people who are interested. Now, that's what Gene Scott's about. Somebody called me today and said that the LA Times was going to do an in-depth story on me. My God, how many have they done? And while I was making a call to Ed Masry about that, he's on the phone talking, CBS called. They're going to do a five-part series on people's choices in religion. They want to feature me in some Lutheran church and Bob Schuller. Why can't I just teach and be left alone? I try to teach people how to get to heaven without being religious. Hell's going to be populated with religious people. 1905, Albert, I'm reading from Earth and Upheaval, Emanuel Velikovsky and the address he gave at Princeton, which is a supplement at the end of the book. In 1905, Albert Einstein, then 26 years old, offered his understanding of the physical world, an understanding that required a new mental approach as a testimonial that the age of basic discoveries had not ended with the victory of Darwin over the book of Genesis. Now, just think about it for a minute. Can you see it now? 15,000 in the Long Beach Coliseum. Jimmy Swaggart preaching. The saints praying. And Jimmy Swaggart turns the light on for Einstein, and he comes to the altar. Think of it. There's drama for you. Einstein, searching for reality. Finally, someone tells him to fly to Lynchburg. Albert Einstein, in order to get to heaven, must listen to Tammy sing and sit in a hot tub for Jesus with Jimmy. I want to tell you, if your approach to God and religion can't make an Einstein interested and comfortable and feel like God's not against him because he's got a mind that at 26 shattered the fixations of the mental set of this century, then it's an awful small God that conceived that religion. Let me say that again. If what is being presented as religion cannot make an Einstein sit up and take notice and realize that he doesn't have to sacrifice that brain power to add an understanding of God to what he's doing, then it ain't much of a religion. And if it seems a bit incongruous that an Einstein must sit there and be bellowed at for 30 minutes by a sweating, swaggering megalomaniac in order to come to Jesus, then isn't it kind of a put down to suggest that the rest of us have to follow that route? As I said, they're all a bunch of assholes, these television evangelists. Since then, another 50 years have passed. Am I boring you? It makes no difference to a television evangelist. 50 years, 100 years, 5,000 years. They still got the same message. Nothing. Do this and don't do that. Religion or nothing, or religion or do-do. Take your choice. Since then, another 50 years have passed. Once more, as before the end of the 19th century, we are told that the fundamentals are all known. The age of basic discoveries is definitely terminated. This time for certain. And present and future generations will have to satisfy themselves with detecting details, accumulating data, and adding decimals. Details without the head. And though the exciting decade of 1895 to 1905 threw light on processes in matter, life, and soul, processes that are certainly not inert and are marked by spontaneity and conflict, science in its various branches adjusted the new discoveries and ideas to the framework of the old great principle reigning equally in lifeless, living nature, the law of harmony and unperturbed stability. That's fundamentalism. The time, he said, was ripe for heresy. What if I could get CBS to run a five-part series in which they did these others, and then they said, and now we'll take a look at the joyous heretic. I think I'd go for that. The joyous heretic. Jesus was one. He was a heretic to the Pharisees. Paul was one. He was a heretic to the James crowd. Luther was one. He was a heretic to the Catholic world. Wesley was one. He was a heretic to the Anglican communion. The time was ripe for heresy. In 1950, a book, Worlds in Collision, created an outburst of emotions almost unprecedented in science. In the preface to the book, I wrote, quote, "Harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres is the point of departure of the present-day concept of the world as expressed in the celestial mechanics of Newton and the theory of evolution of Darwin. If these two men of science are sacrosanct, this book is a heresy. And if Jimmy the Jerk and Jerry the Fat are sacrosanct, I am a heretic." I'm leading up to something, as I usually am. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I'm asking for cryptic responses. I notice I don't get them too well unless I'm here live. I guess even though you're being cryptic, you like to have a cryptic reader here of your cryptic responses. Now, give me some music as we join Texas so I can pick this up and go to where I'm going. Can I see every phone jammed?
Well, I even had music and had people call in those days. Phone number wasn't hardly big enough to be seen, but it was the same number. 1-800-338-3030. Now, this is your chance, you know. You were supposed to be making reservations and not listening. You were listening and not calling. But this is music. You can see some, you know, sort of poorly taken movies taken by one of my staff people that was at a stamp show in Spain, showing you some of the countryside around Segovia. So enjoy it. Let the same music play, the same picture. You get on the phone, and I'm going back to this cataclysmic theory. Get on the telephone.
Ogden, Kansas. Where did he get his Ph.D.? Stanford University, 57. In what? Philosophies of Education. What was his bachelor's? In history. How did he get into the ministry? I really don't know. Thanks. God called me into a wilderness of ignorance to try to provide an alternative. That's it. In 1950, don't take any more calls, a book I'm reading from Emmanuel Velikovsky, Earth in Upheaval. In 1950, a book, Worlds in Collision, created an outburst of emotions almost unprecedented in science. In the preface to the book, I wrote, I'm a rebel with a cause, by the way. Quote, harmony or stability in the celestial and terrestrial spheres is the point of departure of the present-day concept of the world as expressed in the celestial mechanics of Newton and the theory of evolution of Darwin. Harmony and stability. If these two men of science are sacrosanct, holy, this book is heresy. End quote. Velikovsky speaking in an address he made to Princeton. I came upon the idea that traditions and legends and memories of generic origin can be treated in the same way in which we treat, in psychoanalysis, the early memories of a single individual. I spent 10 years on this work. I found that the collective memory of humankind spoke of a series of global catastrophes that occurred in historical times. You know what he's saying there. You're smart. As psychoanalysis had uncovered the false impression that the tranquil personality of many people hides deep-seated traumas in their personal history, Velikovsky came upon the idea that the traditions and the legends and the myths that across the board are a part of the historic accumulation in the culture of mankind, like psychoanalysis treats the memories of a single individual, all these legends form a collective memory, he says, of humankind, which speak of global catastrophes, series of them, that occurred in historical times. I believed, Velikovsky said, that I could even identify the exact times and the very agents of the great upheavals of the more recent past. The conclusions at which I arrived compelled me to cross the frontiers in the various fields of science. And I could add to his speech, that he was coming up against a world of specialists, too, who looked at the world from their little myopic discipline. And there are very few Gestaltists around. The reason Reinhold Niebuhr was able to shake the religious world, he had a Gestaltic knowledge of just about every field and the role that religion could play. This has been the age of specialists, and the broadly learned man is a rarity. Velikovsky was compelled to cross the frontiers into various fields of science, archaeology, geology, and astronomy. The result was a book, a prolegomenon, in its concluding pages, I conceded that more problems were raised than had been solved. That's the way with the pursuit of knowledge in all cases. You keep saying, well, you're always dangling. Will you expand the circumference of knowledge? You got a much wider border of new questions. Now, these people who zealously affect you and seek to put you underneath their pea brain, have few questions left to answer. And to that crowd, some poor little jerk's affair in a motel some years ago is titillating. I think I read in the paper today. It said both evangelists had a fling with this girl. Isn't that what you read today? All of which she blamed on one glass of wine. You think the whole of horny mankind has lived 2,000 years in the Christian centuries and never discovered what one glass of wine could accomplish for them? I mean, this story continues to defy belief. One glass.
Roll that back to where I would cigar so you can pick up that. Just roll it back so that you don't break in the middle of the sentence. Go back to where I had the cigar before I said one glass of wine. Now, there are probably people living today that don't remember the Jimmy Baker and the Jimmy Swaggart scandals. But I was blasting the TV evangelist before their behavior became public. I mean, my Lord, I fired Jim Baker first year I came to town off this network publicly. The news media came around many years later. I took this network out of the national religious broadcasters. NRB. I took them out. Now, wait a minute. And I announced to them why. And I changed the name of the acronym from National Religious Broadcasters to Not Real Bright. Remember that? And I said the reason is they got Jimmy Swaggart and Jimmy Baker as their keynote speakers too many times. I don't associate with those people. But there are people probably listening don't remember. How that 14-minute affair? I think that's the national average. What's the big deal about that? I read somewhere that's the national average. I don't know if it's changed with Viagra, but that's what I read. That 14-minute affair. All because of a glass of wine. Occupies all the news media. I think the cataclysmic theory is much more important than pick up where I was.
If one glass of wine would do that, I'd corner the market. But based on the way that girl looks, I'd want all the wine first. Three bags. I conceded that more problems were raised than had been solved. And I promised.
always reckoning with the limitations of the individual scholar. To pursue my study into these fields. Two. But already the implications of the fact of great global catastrophes on the earth. Had caused my critics to assert. In the words of a Harvard astronomer, thank God we've gotten way out there now, that here was the most amazing example of a of a shattering of accepted concepts on record. It's amazing how the mind can read whatever it wants into what's written on these pages. In the heat! In the heat of the debate in the press, the book was pronounced one of the most significant books written since the invention of printing. And at the same time, the worst book since the invention of movable characters. Believing that an emotional atmosphere is not well suited to fruitful debate, I have entered only infrequently into the controversy. I've made short factual corrections of statements by the royal astronomer and by J.B.S. Haldane, appearing in their reviews of my book. Why would you worry about a guy reviewing your book whose initials are B.S.? And I participated in a debate with your professor of astronomy, J.Q. Stewart, in the pages of Harper's Magazine. In other words, he argued a few times, but not much. And neither did they. Now more than 3.5 years have passed since the publication of the book, and I appreciate the opportunity offered me by your invitation to present a dispassionate review of recent finds in the three fields named in the title of my address. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir!
In my book, Worlds in Collision, I describe the great natural catastrophes of the second and first millennia before the present era. That's from 3000 B.C. to Christ. That's the period we've been looking at. That second millennium, the period when the pyramid was alleged to be built by Khufu. Prominent place is given in my book to the description of the natural upheaval that occurred in the closing hours of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt. Now, the Middle Kingdom came to end about the 15th century. I synchronize this event with the Exodus, when sea, land, and sky were in uproar. Now, don't ask me to park my brain when I become a Christian. Once I believe in God, starting with the astounding beginning point of Christianity, that he raised Christ from the dead, then I don't have any trouble assuming the existence of a God who's powerful enough to stop the sun, as the visual view of it describes it in the Bible. The Bible's not describing in scientific terms. He's describing the way it looks. They're giving perceptual descriptions of an occurrence. We'd have more critics of the Bible that say it was fraud and written in late centuries and
laid out in the sun to make it look like it's old parchment. If we were to read in the Bible that the earth orbiting upon its axis stopped or slowed down until the appearance was that the sun stood still in the sky. They didn't have that knowledge. They described the way it looked to them. But scientific knowledge makes us know that something affected the orbital process of the earth to give that perceptual view. Now, I have no difficulty believing that God can cause that. The phenomenon of Joshua's long day. I get a little angry when I come to believe that God can do that. He doesn't do it for me more often. I mean, I know lots of days that he should have lengthened, and some he should have sped up real fast. And I intend to ask God what kind of special deal Joshua had that I didn't get. I ain't ever stopped the sun yet. But don't ask me to believe that happened in Palestine and the rest of the world's clocks and view of reality was unchanged. I mean, if somebody had a long day, then somebody else had a long night. I expect a little baby boom from some section of the earth. And they had a blackout in New York. Population went up. That's been demonstrated. How many remember the blackout in New York? Don't tell me where you were. Or what you were doing. You don't have to confess those things to me in my church. I ain't gonna tell you where I was. Or what I was doing. All Velikovsky is saying is he set out to synchronize with the current archaeological and historic discoveries. If these events in Exodus occurred at the close of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, then there ought to be evidence of strange physical occurrences in other cultures that it was not the job of the biblical record to take into account. The collective human memory, he says, retained an inexhaustible array of recollections of the time when the world was in conflagration, when sea engulfed land, earth trembled, celestial bodies were disturbed in their motion, and meteorites fell. My narrative is based on historical texts of many peoples around the globe, on classical literature, on epics of northern races, on sacred books of the Orient and Occident, on traditions and folklore of primitive peoples. The question that arose was, where is the archaeological evidence? This is a follow-up to his Worlds in Collision. In Worlds in Collision, he had described in the collective historic texts, classic literature, epics around the world, a collective memory of catastrophic events happening about this time. The question that arose, therefore, was where is the archaeological evidence? In later chapters of my book, I gave such evidence, water clocks and sundials that show a different length of the day or altered latitudes, change in the orientation of ancient temples which originally faced toward the east but do so no longer. I also closely examined in my book the calendars of the civilized peoples of antiquity, from Mexico and Peru to Greece, Iran, Israel, Egypt, Babylon, Assyria, India, and China. Now, of course, you know, Jimmy Swaggart, the scholar, was preaching the other day, proving that the Catholics have no right to their preeminence, which he says is based on Paul and Peter both being at Rome, because when Paul wrote the letter to Rome, he greeted everybody but Peter, therefore Peter wasn't there. Once in a while, he attempts to prove to us that he only went to the third grade. Therefore, God doesn't hear the prayers of Catholics. That Jew, or Jew, that jerk, would conclude. Once jerk, always jerk. You see Velikovsky sitting in the audience in Long Beach Coliseum, being stricken in his brain and heart with the wisdom of the gospel as presented by Jimmy the Jerk, and running forward to throw his cigarettes on the altar. Seems a bit incongruous, doesn't it? Well, isn't it a put down to suggest that the rest of us have to go through that work on your routine? This material, archaeologically, gave strong support to the literary evidence. Working independently of me, Professor Claude Schaefer, whose earlier excavations at Ras Shamra, the Ugarit civilization, caused a complete revolution in biblical exegesis, published a volume printed by the Oxford University Press. In this very detailed and technical work, comprising together with tables almost 1,000 pages, Schaefer demonstrates that on several occasions, each marking the end of an epoch, the entire ancient East was shaken and devastated. Modern annals of seismology know nothing comparable in severity and extent. The most devastating of these upheavals took place at exactly the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, causing its downfall, as claimed in Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
I am going somewhere. I'm going to another book. Play some music.
Now, if you just joined us, what I'm doing is playing a classic teaching session on the cataclysmic theory and on, and I'm coming to the canopy theory to explain no rain before the flood and the impossibility of 40 days rain flooding the earth. The biblical description is the fountains of the deep opened up and the waters above poured out. People read through King James hundreds of times and pay no attention to the statement in Genesis that God separated the waters and put a firmament between them. Now, firmament simply means expanse. We get our word firmament from the Latin, but the Hebrew word simply means an expanse. An expanse between the waters above and the waters below. Now, I was a Pasadena scientist. Bale was his name. He first proposed the canopy theory as an explanation of a lot of things. You could only see through that canopy of ice or vapor or water only the brightest lights, the sun, maybe the brightest stars, the worship of the dragon across the sky in the far east, be the way the sun would look going across the sky. longevity of life without the harmful rays of the sun. A complete difference in carbon-14 and the relationship between carbon-14 and carbon-12, which is the basis for half-life dating, 5,000 plus years each half-life. A total different atmosphere, the hothouse effect, which explains mammoths frozen in place with food still in their stomach in a subtropical area found in Siberia. I'm coming to that canopy theory and the idea of a cataclysm, that the Bible talks of cataclysms. There was a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. King James says the earth became a waste and desolation, or was a waste and desolation. It's just perfect tense, past, could be became. Became a waste and a desolation, which is the way it's translated in Jeremiah. So this is teaching back in 1987. But the purpose for playing this old classic tape is twofold. You had a dish, KU band, or shortwave radio, or internet access, or a big dish. If you ever own KU band, you get it for less than $500. There's no zoning restrictions, and you can pull us down digital 24 hours a day. The station most of you are watching right now, 56. You go to any one of the TV supply shops and ask them how to get whatever you have to get for your TV to pick up high-definition television. And we are the second channel 24 hours a day on channel 56. I've had callers say, I went down to Radio Shack or somebody, I can't remember the company they named, less than $200. My regular TV, we installed it, box or something, and now I get 56 picking up off our satellites 24 hours a day on their high definition channel. All TVs, new TVs, usually come with that equipment, a part of them, because all TV stations have to switch to that eventually. There's a big transition going on in the broadcast world. This kind of teaching is 24 hours round the clock. This kind of teaching is ageless. I mean, he's older than me, that guy that teach him there. He looks older anyway. Needs a haircut. He really does need a haircut. But at least he's got hair. More than I can say for some of my congregants, they had hair when I came here. They've lost it. I still got mine. Amazing what happens in 29 years. Now, you need to be making reservations when the music plays. And we are celebrating, if you make the reservations, we'll be at the cathedral a week from Sunday for my 29th anniversary, starting my 30th year. Now, any of you that are under the illusion that I'm not going to be around a while and that I'm not going to finish Romans, you are not just under an illusion, you're delusional.
Yes, sir.
I'll be around a long, long time.
Yes, sir.
The unknown can get me. I've set my life to the unknown's worse than the known and set my emotions for the worst. But when I know who the enemy is or what the enemy is, I go into an attack mode, me and God, and you if you want to go along. But I want you to make reservations, making them while the music plays, because obviously you're listening to the teaching, even though it's done in 1987. You can listen to teaching on these subjects, pyramids, leaf-cutting ants in Brazil, how the walruses at the Arctic Circle remind me of deacon boards, the organization of leaf-cutting ants in Brazil reminds me of denominations. It's amazing what you can see as you look at life. Pyramids, lost tribes, various books of the Bible we've taught through verse by verse. Round the clock, We are going around the world by satellite and by shortwave radio. You shouldn't have to just listen to this Sunday night 4 hours and from 10 to 11. We're there 24 hours a day if you just open your eyes to the other access media available. We're just 1 hour a night on 56 from 10 to 11. That's more than most of you can stand. But to those that really want the teaching, get a shortwave radio. You can pick us up anywhere in the world. Inquire about the small dish that you can establish, and we have our own DirecTV 24 hours a day, digital TV. We're on GE3 Transponder 20, the big dish, 24 hours a day. Live on the internet. Go to the home page and punch the entry channels. If you surf the web, you can pick us up around the clock. You don't have to just listen at this one time. And really, all our programming is aimed toward people who seriously want to study and listen to the teaching, not the riffraff that just channel surf. That's one of the reasons why I only have two kinds of people who listen to me: those who hate me and those who love me, the dumb ones and the smart ones. Now, get on the phone when music plays, and we're going back to this 1987 teaching. For those who just joined us, I'm reading from Emmanuel Velikovsky's Earth in Upheaval. At the close of that particular book and his many books, he includes an address he made to Princeton University, which was a follow-up to his book, Worlds in Collision. In essence, he had taken issue with the reigning view of things, that all things continue as they are now continuing. The harmony and stability in the history of the universe, with rare, if any, major catastrophes, which were necessary to the harmonious unfolding of the theories of evolution. He is now giving an address after years of the book being out and creating quite a stir, which is a follow-up to his book. He says, working independently of me, Professor Claude Schaefer, whose earlier excavations at Ras Shamra of the Ugarit civilization caused a complete revolution in biblical exegesis. He sure did. It's like the digs at Ebla, brand new. And for political reasons, the scholars have still not had a free hand there. But at least they have uncovered a creation story that can be dated about 300 to 500 years earlier than the Babylonian story. And critics of the Bible had said the Babylonian story of the creation, because it was penned about 300 years earlier than the biblical record, if it's credited to Moses, therefore the biblical record must have drawn on the Babylonian record. But in Ebla, they find a record closer to the biblical record that was 300 to 500 years earlier than the Babylonian record. So much for scientific premature conclusions. In this very detailed work that Schaefer did, comprising together with tables almost 1,000 pages, Schaefer demonstrates that on several occasions, each marking the end of an epoch, the entire ancient East was shaken and devastated. Modern annals of seismology know nothing comparable in severity and extent to these past catastrophes. Now, the major thesis and concentration of Velikovsky's work has to do with the close of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, which recently archaeology has coincided with the exodus out of Egypt by the Hebrews. Archaeology has pushed the exodus back at least 250 to 300 years into the 15th century, and the Middle Kingdom has been dated too far back. And Velikovsky's work has shown that the ending of the Middle Kingdom
and the Exodus and the biblical record are near simultaneous happenings. He is also showing that cataclysms have been a habit pattern of this earth. And the most devastating of these upheavals in modern history took place at exactly the end of the Middle Kingdom in Egypt, causing its downfall, as claimed in Velikovsky's works, Worlds in Collision and Ages in Chaos. Cities were overturned, epidemics left the dead piled in common graves, the pursuit of arts and commerce came to an abrupt end, empires ceased to exist, strata of earth, dust, and ashes yards thick covered the ruined cities. In many places the population was annihilated, in others it was decimated. Settled living was replaced by nomadic existence. Climate changed. Claude Schaeffer analyzed the archaeological fields of every place excavated from Troy at the Dardanelles over all Asia Minor, Armenia, the Caucasus, Persia, Syria, Cyprus, and Palestine to Egypt and Africa. He summarizes his extensive volume in this way, quote, "Our inquiry has demonstrated that these repeated crises, which opened and closed the principal periods of the third and second millennia, were not caused by the action of man. Far from it, because compared with the vastness of these all-embracing crises and their profound effects, the exploits of conquerors would appear only insignificant." Schaeffer's work sheds a new light on the conclusions at which Sir Arthur Evans arrived after many years of archaeological work on Crete. The island was shattered in violent catastrophes that were accompanied by fire, and in these upheavals the cultural and political ages of the Minoan kingdom went down, at the same time that corresponding Egyptian ages were terminated. Troy III was destroyed and its 50-feet-thick fortress wall fell when the Middle Kingdom in Egypt fell. The volcano on the island of Terra exploded with almost unimaginable fury. Recent archaeological work in the Indus Valley showed, too, that about 1500, and in advance of the Aryan invasion, cities with great walls were destroyed and a flourishing civilization came to a sudden end. The synchronization of the Exodus with the end of the Middle Kingdom was also the starting point of a reconstruction of ancient history from that point on to the advent of Alexander the Great, which took the form of a two-volume work, Ages in Chaos, the first volume of which was published in the spring of 1952, and which coordinates recent archaeological finds, telling the story of the Exodus and the physical happenings in Egypt from the Egyptian side. The problem of the time of the Exodus in Egyptian history has never been solved. Of course, the pyramid gives a date, and the time solution keeps getting closer to it. The problem of the time of the Exodus in Egyptian history, which the pyramid gives as 1453 B.C., had never been solved. In the papyrus, Ethuria, and the Naos of El Arish, two archaeological finds, I found descriptions of a natural upheaval very similar, sometimes identical with the description in the book of Exodus. These are heathen records archaeological digs have uncovered in Egypt. Their descriptions are as follows. Following plagues when the river was blood-colored, amid a hurricane and darkness of 7 days' duration, the Pharaoh and his host were drowned in a whirlpool at Pihath-Keloth, the same place where the Pharaoh of the Exodus was drowned. These parallels compel me to fix an unorthodox date for the Exodus, because he was competing with the tradition that the Exodus took place in the 12th century, based upon some very faulty genealogical records that never made any distinction between a son and a grandson. So under the enslavement of Bishop Usher and his followers, who dated the earth and its happenings by genealogies, and as I said, when we looked at Genesis 9:10-11, if you read from the Septuagint, the one that Jesus quoted and Paul quoted, which doesn't really make it absolutely authoritative on those things, they had 100 years to each of those people's, the patriarchs' lives. The genealogies give hints They're not absolute dating methods. And using genealogies, the world had settled on the 12th century as the date of the Exodus. The pyramid said 1453, the 15th century. These works by Velikovsky pushed it to within 7 years of 1453. Velikovsky's coordinates are 7 years off from the pyramid, using archaeology and various other events, which are much more, I mean, a seven-year deviation when you're back at 1400, 15th century B.C. These parallels compel me to fix an unorthodox date for the Exodus. Collating the historical texts of following generations for 1,200 years, I could establish numerous correlations between the histories of Egypt and of Israel which could not be accidental. My reconstruction demonstrated that Egyptian histories and the histories of the nations which are written in harmony with it are out of line with the historical past by about 600 to 700 years. And this is the book where he does most of that, Ages and Chaos. His vast collating showed most traditional history to be off about 600 to 700 years. That's why I told you the other night, a 500-year spread means nothing when you're back that far. It's too hot in here. Thus, both my works have their starting point in the recognition that the Middle Kingdom in Egypt went down in a great natural catastrophe. The recent excavation in Jericho has confirmed the fact that the great walls of the city fell a few decades after the end of the Middle Kingdom, but at the time in which conventional chronology places the arrival of the Israelites under Joshua and Canaan, there was no city at Jericho and no walls to fall. According to Ages and Chaos, however, the Israelites came to the walls of Jericho one generation after the end of the Middle Kingdom. And the enigmatic hiatus of 600 years proves not to be real. I expect new evidence from the Minoan scripts and the so-called Hittite pictographs. Texts in the Minoan, Linear B, script were found years ago on Crete and in Mycenae, and in several other places on the Greek mainland. I believe that when the Minoan writings unearthed in Mycenae are deciphered, they will be found to be in Greek. I also claim that these texts, and he was proved right, by the way, I also claim that these texts are of a later date than generally believed. No dark age of 6 centuries duration intervened in Greece between the Mycenaean age and the Ionian age of the 7th century. Before long, he says, new evidence will come from the so-called Hittite pictographic writings found in Asia Minor. Hittite civilization, they didn't even know it existed until a relatively recent archaeological find. Before long, new evidence will come from the so-called Hittite pictographic writings found in Asia Minor, Mesopotamia, and northern Syria. Since the recent discovery of Kara Tepe in Asia Minor of bilingual inscriptions in ancient Hebrew and in pictographs, efforts at decipherment have entered a new stage. Today, the Hittite pictographs are already in the process of being read. In my reconstruction, I come to the conclusion that they are Chaldean signs. Not Hittite. Now, you need to follow Abram and all of his power under Terah when they settled in Haran. Haran was dead before they got there. The most logical explanation for the name of Haran is they named it for his brother. He's a powerful people. Terah had been a ruler in Nimrod and Samiris's great city. The scientific view and the traditional view is that man came out of the cave, grabbed some woman by the hair, and started a family. Ate bugs until he learned to use a club. And man has progressively gotten better. That whole view is the antithesis of the biblical view. Now, I went through a loss of faith in university by people passing on these regurgitated ideas that they got out of their textbook thoughtlessly and mindlessly. And I'm on a crusade, not necessarily to convince people of the biblical view, but at least to make the point it's not ridiculous.
That's what I said. What I said, see, we're live right now. And I can interrupt that old man that was teaching in 1987. Now, I'm going to go on after I summarize Velikovsky and introduce a book, The Waters Above, by Joseph C. Gillow. And I then go through that. This was a pretty long festival. And go through Joseph Dillow's book that takes the canopy theory and approaches it scientifically with detail unlimited, it seems. Now, I said at the time I wanted that book, The Waters Above, by Dillow, a large order of inventory to be kept in the bookstore. So when I began to think about playing this classic, I queried, do we have any copies? No. Do we have any? Not the hiccups, so that'll prove to you it's live. Because otherwise they'd cut this out if we were not live. So I had my wife get on the internet. See if you can find one of these books. Book finders, Abe Books, all the... We called every bookstore in town. I couldn't even find it in their records. She found me 2 copies. They run $140 to $190 a piece. Used. On the internet. Now, I'm not going to play the whole festival tonight. You go get yourself a dish. Go on the internet. This is the kind of teaching that plays round the clock, 24 hours a day, on this network. You know, I'd be a little happier if my staff would listen to, at least, you know, when they're playing, if there could be some guy listen and keeping notes the first time it's played and figure out that maybe with our editing machines, you ought to take out me saying it's too hot in here. Did you pick up on that? Or too cold in here. You know, I can live with, first time to play it on the network was 70,000 hours. Those remarks, because every program was live when it was first recorded, going by. But after it plays once on the network, somebody's supposed to be keeping notes. And then you take that tape and you take out. It's too hot in here. I mean, it might be replay in the middle of December in Alaska. And they're going to say, is something wrong with his thermostat? You know what I mean. But, you know, that's that urge to be better that I try to pass on, and not always too successful in getting people to pay attention. But I'll bet you caught it. It says too hot in here. But I'm not going to play the rest of that. You want to read the book, The Waters Above, which is the most scientific defense of the canopy theory. Go on the internet and get ready to pay upwards of $100 to $200 and get behind me. I got the only 2 available. Now, I know what's going to happen. A bunch of you people that I gave free copies to at a banquet are going to put them on the internet now. the tithe and the first fruits of the Lord. Got that? Now, about 15 minutes from now, we're going to go to this morning service as it happened in the cathedral. So you only got 15 minutes to get real busy on the telephone and make your reservation for the cathedral next Sunday. I played an old classic tape, thought I would sit here and calls would pour in while I sat here, and the voices of faith sat here and took your calls. You listened. Well, if you're that interested, why don't you get a dish? Why don't you get the equipment to be 24 hours on 56 here in Los Angeles on the high-definition channel? Why don't you get a shortwave radio at the very least? You can listen around the clock. Get a big dish if you're in an area that they don't prohibit in the zoning, and if there is a zoning restriction, call here and find out what the coordinates are. If you buy a small dish, it'll cost you less than $500. You can listen around the clock. Right now, wherever you are, you're listening, and we're live. And I want you to make the reservations from the Los Angeles area for next Sunday. The rest of you, call in, you regular congregants of mine, and do what you know you're supposed to do on Sunday. Get on the telephone. You know, we went on in Flint, Michigan this morning for the first time. Always the same. People call. I used to watch you years ago. It's so nice to see you back. San Francisco, they're waking up to the fact we're on every night and on every Sunday morning. Always enjoying the program. Dallas, Texas. A host of calls from Dallas, Texas this morning. Washington, D.C., Nashville, Tennessee. And in the contract with Hartford, only one Sunday out of the 52 weeks that was pre-committed, so we were not on in Hartford today. We'll be right back next Sunday and the rest of the year, or however long the contract is, but at least a year. And as I said, we just started in Flint, Michigan today. The ministry keeps expanding as we return to cities across America that we used to be in on a pretty regular basis. And the response is always the same. Glad to have you back. Now, in about 5 minutes, we'll play the last song before we go into this morning service at the cathedral. So you've got to get busy. Get on the phone, making your reservations. From Dallas, Texas, amazing calls. Alvarado, this was an incredible message about the blood. I've never heard such a wonderful presentation on this subject before. This is my first time seeing Dr. Scott. I'd like a copy of the message. Granbury, Texas, my name is, and I watch every Sunday. I go to the Church of God in Granbury, Texas. I quit going to Sunday school so I could listen to you. I want you to know how much I love and appreciate you and your teaching. I'm so tired of the, quote, stuff I get at church. I watched you years ago when you were on in Dallas every night, and I just wanted to say that. Thank you. Dallas, first time. Wonderful program. I was sick today. Tune in to Dr. Scott. Tune in to his wonderful teaching. I will tune to the website, and I'm never going back to my own church again. Fort Worth, Texas. I'm calling to tell Dr. Scott how much we enjoy him. This is deep reach teaching, and I'm enjoying it. Waxahachie, Texas. Now, my voice of faith wrote Wakakaki. Wakakahi. No, it's Waxa. Now they've thrown me off. I knew it before I read this Wakakaki. I want to do the spiritual emphasis week at a Bible school there. We've been watching you a few months. We used to go to Waxahachie. I think. We've been watching for a few months. We used to go to service during this time, and now we stay home and watch Dr. Scott. And Dallas, thank you for being on 27. It makes Dallas a much better place, and lots of other messages that I didn't read to you. Same from the other cities. At the end of the next song, or sometime during the next song, we will take you into the cathedral for this morning service. So this is your last time to call during music. make your reservations, and then enjoy the service as it happened this morning from the curtain rise. Go to music.